I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Last November, the Democratic candidate for governor of Georgia, Stacey Abrams, refused to concede to her opponent, Republican Brian Kemp. She declared, "As a leader, I should be stoic in my outrage and silent in my rebuke, but stoicism is a luxury and silence is a weapon for those who would quiet the voice of the people." She filed a lawsuit charging gross mismanagement. Kemp not only ran against her, he ran the election as Secretary of State and had purged thousands of voter registrations. A few months later, Stacey Abrams delivered the Democratic Party's response to President Trump's State of the Union address, the first African-American woman to do so, avoiding the so-called State of the Union curse. And Marco Rubio knows what I'm talking about. She talked in personal terms about her parents' family values and about her vision for the country.
"Our progress has always been found in the refuge, in the basic instinct of the American experiment, to do right by our people. And with a renewed commitment to social and economic justice, we will create a stronger America together. Because America wins by fighting for our shared values against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That is who we are. And when we do so, never wavering, the state of our union will always be strong. Thank you, and may God bless the United States of America."
Stacey Abrams joins us on Radio Times today with a sold-out audience of WHYY listeners and supporters, a stop on her multi-city tour about her book, Lead from the Outside, How to Build Your Future and Make Real Change. Stacey Abrams, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Are you getting used to that kind of
applause not at all.
That you're getting?
Not at all. I like it. I just, but the minute you start getting used to it, you're about to go on the downward slide. So I am always appreciative.
I don't like to start interviews with negatives, but you are not the governor of Georgia.
Really?
You did not win, but you did not concede. But I wonder whether not being the governor of Georgia has given you this platform to talk about policies and to make a difference in this country.
I would rather be governor, but
would you?
Because as governor, not only would I have the platform, I'd have the ability to execute. And so I don't want to diminish how important that role is, especially in a state like Georgia, where we just saw two of the most egregious bills I've seen during my tenure in the legislature pass. One, but before I get into the content of the bills, I would say this. I appreciate the opportunity to continue to have a voice. And I think the responsibility of every American is to talk about our values and what we want to see. And as someone who has been a part of the public sector as a legislator and before that as an attorney, I think you should use every platform available to push this out and push out a reaffirmation of who we are and what we want. And so I am deeply grateful for the space that I have and for the fact that people clap, but more importantly, that they listen, respond, and engage. But I'd rather be governor.
Right. And you mentioned a couple of bills that I guess as governor you probably would have vetoed.
Well, I wouldn't have let them get the traction
where they got.
So one is that we are about to purchase what have been referred to as the worst voting machines in America. And the company that's the front runner just so happened to have been the employer of the new governor's deputy chief of staff and general counsel right before they came on board. And it's the largest single purchase of machines in American history in terms of $150 million. Now there are some other companies bidding, and hopefully one of those other companies will win, because otherwise we are watching gross corruption take place and the setup for the theft of the 2020 election, because these are hackable machines. And then just last week on Friday, the state legislature passed HB 481, a forced pregnancy bill that would impose an abortion ban at 6 weeks before women know they're pregnant, and would criminalize doctors if they provided any services to women, particularly women who are facing issues like miscarriage. You have to be able to prove that you didn't perform an abortion. It also criminalizes women who seek that medical treatment and they have to prove that they were either raped or the victims of incest by providing a police report.
Wow. Wow. So those are making their way through the government in Georgia.
They are both sitting, well, the governor signed the voting bill and the abortion bill is sitting on his desk.
Wow.
And he has vowed to sign it.
Now, you started this organization, Fair Fight Action, to what, address what happened last fall and sounds like could happen in the future?
So voter suppression is not new to Georgia. That's why we have this wonderful tool called the Voting Rights Act that essentially said you could not create harm an impediment for voters without preclearance from the Justice Department. The evisceration of the Voting Rights Act through the Shelby decision in 2013 opened the floodgates, and Brian Kemp, then the Secretary of State, took full advantage of the lack of oversight. He led the purge of more than 1.5 million voters, shut down or oversaw the shutdown of 214 polling places. He created what is called an exact match system, or perfected it, so that in 2018 alone, 53,000 people were denied the ability to register. They were put on a pending list, 90% of whom were people of color, 70% of whom were African American. He oversaw a process where we had an incredibly high rejection rate of absentee ballots for what were called signature mismatches. If your signature didn't match what was on your voter card or in your driver's license, as I like to say, my signature doesn't match from Kroger to CVS.
Mm.
And yet we were telling people their votes wouldn't count. We had a record number of rejected absentee ballots, but we don't know exactly how many because he refused to actually maintain the database that was supposed to report it. And he allowed 6 million people's Social Security numbers to be made public during his tenure. So what we faced was a combination of gross incompetence and malfeasance. And so Fair Fight Action is designed to use litigation, legislation, and advocacy to fix the electoral system in Georgia. But I want people to understand that what's happening in Georgia is a perfection of a system that is happening across the country.
Voter suppression, you're talking about.
Voter suppression, absolutely.
And is that because of the courts or because on state levels, individuals, parties are able to game the system?
It's because we have 50 different democracies in America. And within each state, depending on how many counties you have, you can subdivide that. So in Georgia, we have 159 different iterations of what should be a singular democratic process. We know that in Arizona, they are attempting to start to shut down access to the right to vote because Arizona is now moving into swing state territory. We know in Indiana and Wisconsin and Michigan and in New York, there have been issues with access to voting rights. So it's not endemic to to Republicans, but they are the largest purveyors. But it's also, we've grown comfortable with this idea that democracy just is. It is not. Democracy is vulnerable. It's resilient, but it's vulnerable. And we have an affirmative responsibility to constantly push for an expansion of democracy and to not sit idly by as constraints are put in place. Because where voter suppression is most effective is when we are convinced that it's an individual responsibility to exercise your rights. We relieve those we elect of the obligation to protect those rights and to renew those rights. And it becomes seamless because if it's your fault or your fault, then nobody has to be held accountable. But when it's a system of disenfranchisement, then we're all in jeopardy because they might come for me first, but they're coming after you next.
Mm. You mentioned abortion, and I wonder whether voting rights is like abortion. And by that, I mean it is legal to have an abortion in this country, but it's also, there are many restrictions, impediments,
absolutely,
roadblocks even for women.
I would say that the way I think about voter suppression, yes, in our country we have a number of rights that are available on paper, but we rely on elected officials and appointed officials to guarantee access. And right now, when it comes to voter suppression, there is not consistent registration access, there's not consistent ballot access, and the third is what I call the Florida problem, getting your votes counted. We know that these have been happening, and this is not new to our issue. This is not a new issue to our nation. Voter suppression is baked into our DNA. It's been present from the inception of our country. The issue is who is newly brought into the system, but also who's being pushed out. And as our demographics evolve, as our politics evolve, as our values evolve, we have seen a certain set of folks with power decide that fewer and fewer people should be allowed to have voice. And that's the danger.
You made it very clear you want to be the governor of Georgia, but nonetheless, your name is being floated in all sorts of directions, including Chuck Schumer, I think, wants you to run for the U.S.
He's mentioned it a time or two.
Senate, running against Senator Perdue. Of course, the vice president thing, you've also kept the door open to the presidency as well. And I ran across a quote from the New Republic that said, I'm going to run to for something, and I will tell you in April. It is April 5th.
Yes.
Is there something you want to tell us?
I would like to tell you hello.
You're no, very look, coy.
Here's the thing. I really am not being coy. This was a self-imposed deadline because back in January when the idea was first floated about me running for the Senate, there are a number of people in Georgia who are also interested in running. I recognize that I begin with some structural advantages having just run a statewide election. And so I set a timetable for myself in part because I wanted to publicly signal that this was not going to be a Hamlet length consideration.
Right.
But it was also because I wanted to give myself a deadline. I'd been thinking about the governor's race for a decade. I am very methodical, as you know from my book.
You have a whole spreadsheet that you started as a younger woman.
I started it on Lotus 1-2-3. So this is... I take
with
this stuff
plan,
seriously.
Right?
Yes, my plans. Because I'm very methodical, and I try to be very deliberate and think through different iterations. But I also believe you have to want the jobs you apply for. Because if you don't want the job, you're not going to do the job well. I'd not thought about the Senate. And the Senate is a critical job. It is an important job that I did not... I know certainly what the Senate does, but knowing what it means to be a senator is different. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to give myself the space to evaluate. However, into that came a few other opportunities I hadn't expected. And so what began as a March timeline changed in part because they reissued my book. I did this little speech responding to the State of the Union. And so the options available to me became larger, and that's really fractured my ability to focus. So I'm not being coy, but I am trying to be deliberate. And I will say, you know, in conversations with Senator Schumer and with others, there's new information about what's possible. And I want to know that I'm the right person, that this is the right time, and it's the right job for me to do. Because going to the Senate, that's a 6-year job.
Right.
If you do it well, it's 12 or 18 years. And I don't think you take a job thinking it's a stepping stone to the next job. And that's the other. I mean, you certainly want to plan for more, but you should assume you're not going to get it. And so you should be ready to be comfortable where you are. And so I'm thinking through what job do I want to have. And it's a very dramatic departure to decide that I'm running for a job that I might be in for the next 20 years of my life.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Stacey Abrams. You probably know her name by now, and she did give the Democratic response to the State of the Union. This was in early February, and her book, Lead from the Outside, is out in paperback, subtitled How to Build Your Future and Make Real Change. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We have a room full of very enthusiastic WHYY and Stacey Abrams supporters here, so stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Our special guest today is Stacey Abrams, and again, her book, Lead from the Outside, now out in paperback, How to Build Your Future and Make Real Change, and again, a packed house here at WHYY. You had lunch with Joe Biden.
I did.
And there was some question about whether he wanted you to be a VP or not. I think you pretty much shot that down. But nonetheless, he's back in the news because several women said that he made them uncomfortable with him touching them. He tweeted, I think this was yesterday, social norms are changing. I understand that. I've heard what these women are saying. Politics to me has always been about making connections, but I will be more mindful about respecting personal space in the future. That's my responsibility, and I will meet it. What's your response, I guess, to what the allegations were against Joe Biden and his response to those allegations?
So I take very seriously the concerns raised by Lucy Flores and others, and I do not believe that there should be any diminution of their discomfort. I think that they are legitimately concerned about how he interacted with them. To a person, they've said that they didn't see anything untoward in terms of, they didn't think of sexual harassment, but it was uncomfortable, right, and it made them feel less safe. That's something he needed to acknowledge, and I know he's had a few statements, one with an apology, one with an explanation. He did the video this week. So I say it in two things. One is that with direct response to Joe Biden, I met him. He is a very tactile person. I'm not. And so it can be discomforting. I wasn't uncomfortable. I just, in politics, you get used to people expressing their affection in right, different ways, and it could be instant affection. I mean, I had a stranger hug me in a line because he heard me say something on something else. And he, for him, it was a genuine expression of thank you. For me, it was, who are you and why are you touching me in public? But I understood his heart was in the right place. He just didn't think about the social cues, and that's okay. But that's because that's how I process it. And so I don't want there to be any sense that we should disregard or ignore how these women feel. I think, though, that as we think about who should be, because it, implicit in the question is, should he be allowed to run for president? The answer is yes. If he publicly has demonstrated that he understands the concerns, if he is willing to be held accountable, and if he's willing to show progress towards atonement, we cannot have as our metric of success in our party in particular, absolute perfection. We will fail. But as people, we will make mistakes. I will make a mistake in this interview and say something that will be taken not out of context. It will be taken in purely right context, and I will still be wrong in some way. And I want us to have the space to be able to apologize, to fix, and to move forward. Now, there are some things that should disqualify you. There are some things that are so egregious as to be irreconcilable. I do not believe this rises to that level. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have to, as a party and as a people, draw clear lines of discernment about what those things are. And that's going to be the thing that I'm going to get in trouble for.
Sure. No, I hear you. This is going to sound like a very partisan question, but I think it just needs to be asked in the context of this, which is that we have a president who bragged on tape about sexually assaulting women. I mean, I just think there's no question about it. He still has majority support from Republicans. He is the president of the United States. Do Democrats and Republicans have a different criteria when it comes to this issue?
They do, but I will say we don't compromise our values because the other side shows no values.
Right.
This should not be a race to the bottom. On this and other issues, a lack of human empathy, a lack of accountability is not an excuse for bad behavior. We are responsible to our own values and our value systems, and we have a high bar. One of the reasons our party is so vibrant is that we invite all identities in. But more than that, we believe that those identities have value and merit and should be given space and audience. The challenge of our party then is how do you reconcile all of those conflicting and competing needs, right, and do so in a way that is respectful, but it's not always going to be equal. The goal is an equity of attribution, not an equality of behavior and reaction. But there should never be the idea that we're going to diminish who we are so we can compete with the other side.
This is a weird segue, but you very publicly said, you know, you carry a lot of debt, and that
yes,
was something that your critics in Georgia tried to hold against you, or mm-hmm, did hold against you. Is there something, and there is no privacy anymore. I mean, that's,
no,
I think, on top of it. Is there something about just getting out front about an issue that is empowering in a way?
Look, I refer to it, and my special assistant Chelsea is going to cringe because she hates it when I say this, but it's kind of my 8 Mile rule. If you've seen the Eminem movie, 8 Mile,
right?
At the end, he does the rap battle, and he says, now you know everything, they know everything you've got to say about me. The idea being that there is no privacy, but also that your mistakes are always going to be fodder for the other side. If those mistakes were earnest and made in good faith, or if they are ones you are atoning for and you want to be held accountable for, go ahead and get it out there. Somebody's going to. Social media has made certain that you can never forget anything. I blame the internet and whoever created it. For me, my debt is something actually I addressed in the book long before the story broke through the financial disclosures. I talk about it because debt's real. It happens to 3/4 of the American population. We have a leader in the White House who bragged about his ability to incur debt and not pay it back. I'm paying my back because the law says I have to. And I want to. It's a moral responsibility. I've paid my tax debt. I'm going to continue to pay back those things I owe because I'm supposed to. But I'm also supposed to take care of my family. I'm supposed to do the things necessary to make my community stronger. And these are competing needs, and my responsibility is to determine the primacy of those needs. For my personal benefit, keeping my father alive took precedence. And so with an ailing father, with a mother who'd been sick, they were raising my niece, I took responsibility both for helping them but also for paying my tax debt, and I put them first. And as I say, look, you can defer taxes. You cannot defer cancer treatment payments. Those are real decisions. And so I think this is a very long way back to your question, which is, right, yes, our foibles, our mistakes are going to be made public. And one thing I talk about in Lead from the Outside is that you can't hope that it's not going to happen. You just have to be prepared for the consequences when it does.
This is a perfect time to ask a question from Evelyn, who said, if you were in charge of everything,
I'm working on it,
what would you do to promote better relations in our divided country?
First is make certain that we aren't fighting because we're competing for a narrow band of resources when there's so much available. What we refer to as income inequality is really a metric of how much are we fighting for survival versus fighting for success. Were I in charge of everything, fighting for survival would not be necessary. Mm-hmm. Fighting for success is a lot easier because you're not worried about whether you can feed your children or make your car payment or get your medicine. When we solve the survival crisis, the success crisis becomes a much different conversation, and people become better to one another because they're not believing, they no longer have this zero-sum belief that my success or someone else's success or survival inherently diminishes my capacity. So I would solve survival. Right.
So getting a little political, is survival then Medicare for all, the Green New Deal, reparations, a living wage? I mean, the things that we're hearing from, I would say, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, but I think also probably the middle of the party as well.
I think if you talk to any person, they would tell you they don't think that you should have to be homeless if you work. They would say that you shouldn't die from a curable disease because you don't have health insurance. We've made these decisions, we just haven't acted upon them. I believe in a public option. I believe in Medicare for all. I don't believe you have to eliminate private insurance. And so I think that's the conversation we need to have. I believe in the intent of the Green New Deal. I don't agree with every part of it because it's a resolution and not a bill that says here's how these things are executed. But I think it's important to have that conversation. I believe that no one should work full time and be unable to take care of themselves. I believe in a living wage. I think that the housing crisis is an absurdity in a nation like the United States. I believe criminal justice reform is critical because it's not just about what happens when you come out of jail, it's why do you go to jail and what happens to you when you're in jail and in prison. And so, yes, there are a range of survival issues that, when properly addressed, actually create the space for us to be the country we say we are, which is a country that is oriented towards success and opportunity. But when you can't get to the starting gate, the rest of it is ephemeral.
And that's Stacey Abrams, our guest on Radio Times today. And again, she's got, it's not exactly a new book, but she has retitled it and reissued it. It's called Lead from the Outside, How to Build Your Future and Make Real Change. Rebecca Traister did a really nice profile of you. And she described you as an old-fashioned Democrat because it's built on civil rights, on labor, the women's movement. Does that fit you?
Yes. I mean, look, I'm a Democrat because I actually read the party's platform. When I was in college, I read the Democratic platform, the Republican platform, the Libertarian platform. I'm from Georgia, so we don't really acknowledge anyone else. And I wanted to make sure I believed. And I didn't actually agree with everything in the Democratic platform. I agreed with the ethos of the Republican platform, which is this notion of opportunity. I just think they're in the wrong country because they presume that there's no racism, sexism, homophobia, ageism, that we didn't disadvantage disability. So, yeah, if everyone were actually equal in the way they're treated, then the Republicans have a good idea. We just have to get to that utopia. And libertarians are fun.
Good. Libertarians are fun.
So I am an old-fashioned Democrat in that I believe we have an obligation to leverage the imprimatur of the state to not ensure success, but to ensure access. And that's the difference. We are often cast as Democrats as believing that everyone deserves the same success, and that's not what we believe. But we believe everyone should have access, and that's why identity is so essential, because you can't provide access if you don't acknowledge what the barriers are. And so in that way, the civil rights movement, the labor movement, the women's rights movement, the LGBTQ movement, the disability activists, they are all necessary to ensure that barriers are removed so that access is really possible.
Where would the Democratic Party be without African-American women? And has the party done enough for African-American women?
So
the most reliable voters, I should say.
Having been one for a very long time, I feel comfortable speaking on behalf of all black women everywhere. Another thing I'm going to get in trouble for.
Yes, exactly.
The party is not just the DNC, and I think that's an important dynamic that we have to talk about. The apparatus of organizing Democrats is called the party. But that consists of not only the national apparatus, it's also state parties, it's candidates, it's consultants, it's donors. They all have to do better. I think there's been in recent years an acknowledgement of the mismatch between expectation and investment. And I think we've seen more happen, especially through the national party. But we're also seeing state parties do better. We're seeing consultants starting to really ask questions. When I ran for governor, there was no research on how a black woman could become governor because nobody really thought about it. We've been here for a few years. Somebody should have done the research. But part of the responsibility, and it's not just that, I mean, African-American women are the largest and most reliable voting bloc, but you have other identities that are coming to the table. And what we need people to learn is that when you lift up black women, because we are so far at the bottom on almost every metric, when you lift us up, you lift up the entire country. And that's the essential necessity of not only our party, but our nation to acknowledge the needs and the voices of black women.
I want to talk a little bit about you growing up and your family, your parents in particular. You grew up in Gulfport, Mississippi, largely. Your parents had a very strict code, it sounds. Go to church, go to school, take care of each other. I also read that your mother said that you could only miss school if you had a doctor's note and a surgical scar.
She didn't say it, but that was pretty much implied.
That's right. I took you very literally in your book,
We took her literally, too. I mean, right. I had the mumps for 2 days before I was like, maybe my face isn't just swelling. I should probably mention something.
Really?
I'm like, Mom, I don't think I should go to school today because I can't talk. my mom and dad took school very seriously. My mother is a first-generation high school graduate. She's the only one of her seven siblings to finish high school. My dad was first-generation college, but my father was dyslexic. So they both went to school every day, in part because my father could not miss a day of school because he had to memorize orally everything he learned because he couldn't read, because they didn't know how to diagnose dyslexia when he was growing up in segregated Mississippi. My mother went to school every day because she was just so determined to break through the cycles of poverty, and it was a respite for her. She had a difficult childhood. And so they both understand that education is so transformative. Before we started, Talia's father asked, a 9-year-old who's in the audience asked what you should do. And part of my answer is my parents believe that we should have boundless expectations. And the way they grounded us was to make sure we never missed a day of school. We were going to know everything so we could figure out anything we wanted.
And you were an excellent student by, it seems like, all accounts. And you tell a story about a teacher who told you to stop using big words.
Yes.
And you essentially went on strike. What did you do?
I went on strike. So this goes to the issue of expectations. I had a teacher. I was, most of my classes, I was the only African-American student. And I was often in gifted classes. So I was in an AP class in 10th grade for English. And I had a very robust vocabulary. My mom was a research librarian. I'd read the dictionary as a kid because, you know, I was like, this book has words. Let me read it. And I like words, and so I would use words properly and in context, and not just to show off, but because I really enjoyed using precise language. And she said that I was making other students uncomfortable and that she would prefer it if I didn't use those big words. And so I was like, okay, then I just won't talk. I'm like, I'm not going to diminish my capacity to satisfy your concerns when they weren't grounded in my best interest. It was because you didn't want other people to feel uncomfortable. Why would they feel uncomfortable with me being capable?
Right.
And so she called my parents in, and my mother and father, before, they wanted to know why they were being summoned to the school for me. I explained it, and they told her, like, no, we didn't raise her to hide who she is. Because the minute she starts to do that, the minute she starts to compromise her capacity to satisfy someone else's lack of whatever, mm-hmm. you're telling her to be less than she is, and that's not how we raise our children.
We're almost up on a break here. We're almost up on a break, in fact, about 30 seconds, but one of the things that you wrote sort of in response to that is that you have consistently through your life confronted sexism, racism, ageism, and biases based on your otherness.
Yes.
You still feel that otherness as of something, something woman?
Just read the Twitter comments.
Yes, there yes. you go.
Look, I break a number of molds, and I am different than the normative on a host of metrics. I'm confronted with it every time someone feels compelled to describe me using not just political leader, but they start to describe all the ways I'm not the thing they're used to seeing. And so whether I explicitly or implicitly acknowledge it, others do.
We're going to take that short break and then get back to our conversation. Again, that's Stacey Abrams, our guest, our special guest on Radio Times today. We're in a packed house here at WHYY talking about politics, talking about her life. And again, her book is titled Lead from the Outside. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. About 10 seconds ago, it was really noisy in here.
Yes.
It's now quiet as a church. And again, Stacey Abrams is our guest. Her book is Lead from the Outside. Has a new title.
Yes. So the original title was Minority Leader, and I love that title, but people didn't quite understand what they thought it was just talking about me in the house. And so Lead from the Outside, we decided, was a much more evocative title, plus I do a new foreword explaining my race for governor and how it ties into the book.
And I should say, Rebecca Tracer, I mentioned before in a profile of you, she described Lead from the Outside as a little like lean in for people who didn't start with any power.
Yes.
Which I thought actually was excellent.
It is. She's a really good writer.
She's an excellent writer. Let me just quote something just before the break. You made a reference to this, and you write, I know that when I offer criticism of men in the workplace, I may be seen as a man hater. I know because I'm not married, I may be seen as a lesbian. I know because I will never be less than curvaceous and wear my hair natural rather than pressed. I may seem as sloppy or unkempt. The plague of the stereotype becomes the reason others cannot imagine how minorities, such as myself, fit into an organization or a role like governor of Georgia or president of the United States or U.S. senator or anything from there. I thought that was just a very powerful and moving section there, both personal but also political.
I mean, the reality is it's true, and we're often taught to obfuscate those pieces of it. I know what people imply when they point out my size. Yes, I'm actually pretty healthy, and I do exercise when I can, but I don't exercise as much as I should. But it's not a question of what size I am. It's, well, does it make her lazy? Does it mean that she's incapable of discipline? I've written 9 books, got 3 degrees. I've done a few things. I've got discipline.
Nothing to apologize for.
Well, no, but but my point is, we use these visual social cues to tell us ourselves stories. And it is disingenuous for us to believe those stories aren't told. Because I have natural hair, there are questions about what does it mean for my, I mean, literally, what does it mean for what she thinks? It means I don't want to do my hair that way. I mean, but there are political imputations in it. And so the point that I was trying to make is that for people who face those stereotypes, we can't pretend they don't exist. Our responsibility is to confront them and to be ready to respond to them. because we all have the stereotypes. Every one of us holds a stereotype about some other community that we are not a part of, or sometimes about our own communities. And our obligation, if we're going to cross those barriers, is to acknowledge the stereotypes exist, be ready to confront them, and make certain that if they do exist, that we're prepared for the harm and the hurt it will cause us to read about ourselves or to be diminished in how we are seen, because it's that response that often makes us stop. We start to believe the stories told about us, and we stop realizing we are who we are.
You also write, fear for minorities is a constant companion.
Yes.
Right this moment.
Absolutely.
All the time.
I mean, I'm afraid that because of something I say, I'm going to somehow cause harm to my entire community. I'm afraid that I'm not going to be able to do certain things I want to do because people are going to worry about the fact that I don't look like what they're used to. I am always terrified that my mistakes are going to be imputed not only to those who look like me, but they're going to be used as fodder to stop others from having things. And those are all real. But what I say is you make fear your friend. I mean, it's going to be with you, so you might as well hang out.
Get to know each other.
Exactly.
You also describe yourself as an intensely private person, really an introvert by nature. Seems like you like your alone time.
I do.
And yet here you are in this such a public job or profession. As you said, you know, people hug you that you've never met before,
do.
And it's a little off-putting. How do you reconcile that?
I hate poverty. I despise the lack, and I tried to be a secret politician that does not actually exist. I attempted to move the policies that I wanted as a bureaucrat, and there are only so many things you can get done if you're not the one speaking. There's when you filter your words or your actions through others, you're never going to get the thing that you really want. Mm-hmm. And so I had to determine what was more important to me, protecting my privacy and my alone time and my introversion, or using the gifts that I have and the skills that I have to try to get the change that I think needs to happen. And in my mind, my responsibility is always to do the work first. And then I watch a lot of TV.
We will get to the TV part of your life. I watch a lot of TV as well. John wants to know, he says, I know it's a democracy, but are the Democrats making a mistake with 10 plus, I think we're now at maybe 15 plus candidates for president, and if so, is there a better way?
No, we have to remember, 92, we had almost as many candidates. I think Paul Tsongas was at the top of the list at this point, and he was not the nominee. So the reality is we live in a democracy that tries to use a primary system to have ideas compete and to let us get to know one another. And there's a winnowing process. And luckily, we've started this 113 years out from the actual election, so we've got time. And so I'm not worried about it, mainly because I trust Americans to actually follow the process. And Democrats in particular, we have a surfeit of opportunity. There are no bad candidates right now. There are some who are better at certain things, but there is nothing worse than what we've got in the presidency right now. I know WHYY isn't partisan. I don't have that problem.
No. How, though, do you suggest Democrats win over those Trump supporters? Or are they win-overable? Is that the goal?
I fundamentally do not believe in political conversion. Convincing someone that what they believe is wrong does not work. I promise you, if I polled 90% of the people in this room about their strongest held belief, I do not think a 30-second commercial and a bunch of flyers is going to make them say, oops, I was wrong, I didn't mean it. But you can convert those who share your values but do nothing about it because they don't vote. And so my approach is you go after the non-voter. You go after the person who already agrees with you. I don't believe in conversion. That's what my parents do. My parents are ministers. Their job is to save your soul. That's work. My job is convincing you that doing this thing that you don't normally do is how you make change. And convincing is a lot easier. And that's how we win elections, not by converting. Yes, 4 million people, I think it was, voted for Trump, who had voted for Obama in 12. But 6 million people stayed home. Those folks are the ones we need to bring back out. The math works.
Greta has a question. What is your best advice for women who are thinking of running for office?
Do it.
Just do it.
Men, and I, with all due respect to really good men, some men will wake up, look in the mirror, and they're like, I'm having a good hair day. I should be in charge of the world. Women have 2 PhDs, 3 masters, and they've actually built small villages. And they're like, but am I prepared? The answer is yes. What you need to be an effective politician is the ability to say you don't know and the willingness to learn. Most of the jobs in politics, there are some that you need to know what you're doing before you get there. But for most people entering politics, it is an inquisitive mind, a good heart, and the willingness to work harder than the next person to see change happen. That's what you have to have.
A question from Mario. How far left can the Democratic Party safely lean on issues like healthcare, climate change, immigration, as it faces the 2020 election?
Again, if we are competing with the right, then there's no left left. We believe in healthcare. This is something we've been talking about since Truman. This is not a new leftist idea that you shouldn't die from curable disease. It is not a new leftist idea that we should probably not all suffocate due to climate change. What is considered left is the fact that the right has moved the ball and we keep chasing it instead of standing our ground and saying, here's what we know to be true and what we're willing to do about it.
And just one more political question from Alberta. Gerrymandering is a contentious issue in Pennsylvania, as I'm sure it's true in other states. I'm not sure about Georgia as well.
Oh, yes.
Just how critical is that issue?
It's so critical that I've started an organization called Fair Count. So Fair Fight Action focuses on voter suppression and fixing our electoral system. Fair Count is focusing on the 2020 census. If you want to end gerrymandering, make certain that undercounted and hard-to-count populations actually get counted. That changes the basic composition of your state, and it makes it harder to ignore those people. If you have overcrowded schools, if you have roads that don't get fully funded, a lot of that happens because we did not participate fully in the census. And so Fair Count will count all, we're going to work to make certain every person in Georgia who is hard to count, immigrants, people of color, poor people, children, that they get counted. If we make certain every person gets counted, then they will count, and that will affect gerrymandering. The other reality is we should have nonpartisan commissions doing the work. I live in a state that doesn't allow independent commissions. We don't have ballot initiatives, so the legislature is going to have to decide to give away its power. I am not holding my breath. I don't know what's happening with you guys, but good luck with that.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. So who is Selena Montgomery?
Selena Montgomery is my nom de plume. When I was in law school, I wrote 2 major works. One was my master's thesis on the operational dissonance of the unrelated business income tax exemption, which I'm sure all of you read. And the second was Rules of Engagement, a romance novel, romantic suspense novel based on my ex-boyfriend's dissertation and my deep fascination with General Hospital and Mission Impossible.
And there are some borderline, I guess, what, steamy sections? I know Stephen Colbert read a little something from your book.
I am steamier than Barbara Cartland, but I'm nowhere near, who's the woman who wrote, I'm not even Jackie Collins. Like, my parents are Methodist ministers in Mississippi. I have to be able to go home. So, yes, Stephen Colbert read I'm a pretty good writer, and I described this really cute kiss. But, no, it's they're steamy, but they're not, like, flaming.
But is being a novelist or even writing fiction, is there something about politics? Is there something similar there, you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, politics is about telling a story about where we can go and who we can be. It's also about being able to put yourself in someone else's story and figuring out that you care anyway. And so in my mind, the ability to tell a good story but also to bring you along for the ride and make you care about the end. It's really good if you can do it in fiction, and it's really effective if you can do it in politics.
Are you going to still continue to write your fiction, or?
So I don't know if I'm going to do romance. I owe my younger sister. She edited every book I wrote, and I started a trilogy. I didn't finish it. I did the first two books, and then I became Democratic leader, so I got a little distracted. I owe her the third book because I really want her to stop asking me about it. And then, you know, I've got a children's book that I'm working on. I had a teenage superhero novel I want to finish one day. Oh, but I've been a little distracted by this other thing I was doing. I'll get back to fiction eventually.
You said you like TV, and there's a lot to like on TV. You're a science fiction nerd?
I am a nerd, absolutely.
Doctor Who?
Doctor
Star
Who's,
Trek?
Yeah, absolutely.
All that.
If you name it, I watch it. I do have some discretion. Battlestar Galactica. I'm not a purist, but I do have, you know, once I decide I like something, like I just started watching Fringe again. A lot of folks didn't watch it. J.J. Abrams, it was a great show. I love just really good television. I like scripted TV. I love The Good Place, which is amazing. And
I read that before you gave the State of the Union, you did a little marathon of Doctor Who watching?
I did indeed. So Doctor Who had a marathon on during... So I watched Tom Baker's Doctor Who because I used to watch PBS all the time. And so they used to run Tom Baker. And then I started watching Doctor Who again because of two of my sisters loved Doctor Who. And I was like, yeah, I like it. So I'd watch it off and on. And then there was a marathon during New Year's Eve. And I was like, ooh, this show is really good. Uh-oh. And so via the State of the Union, I needed to decompress. So I watched about 3.5 hours of season 7.
And that got you into the
it got me
spirit
somewhere.
And got you somewhere.
I was doing that and drinking water, hydrating a lot.
And that's a lot of pressure. I mean, to have a response to the State of the Union.
Yes. When Marco Rubio feels compelled to send you a good luck tweet. Like, that was bipartisanship, man. But I'm like, how bad is this? And Joe Kennedy's like, do not use chapstick. If you do it, be really careful. And I'm like, I don't want to do this anymore. It was an extraordinary opportunity. It was fraught with peril. I mispronounced the word lunar when I practiced.
Oh, what did you say?
I don't remember. It wasn't that word, though.
Was it lunar?
Because we decided to add it in, and so I'm at the teleprompter. And I mangled letters. I think I was speaking Klingon or Valerian or something. So, but I got it right by the time we did this.
Well, it worked.
Thank you.
Stacey Abrams, it's been such a pleasure.
Marty, this has been delightful. Thank you.
And people are standing up and applauding very loudly.
Thank you.
And I'm just going to talk over all the noise. Oh. And let me just say that Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. Our engineers today, Joyce Lieberman and Adam Stanishevsky. Charlie Kyer, Mohammed Wahid. A special thanks to Christine Holbert, Brad Lazuski, and Brandon Black. And I am Marty Moss Cohen, and we do want to close things out on Radio Times. A special shout out to our guests, and this is the theme music from the fourth Doctor Who with Tom Baker. Enjoy.